Dr. Heimlich, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. And I know you are now publishing your autobiography, which is Heimlich's Maneuvers.
Yes.
My 70 years of life-saving innovation.
That's correct.
70 years.
It's my life.
Yeah. You know, one thing I was curious about was, were there particular incidents in your youth that led you to become a doctor, to a career in medicine? Why did you choose this profession?
I remember as a child, and I mean a small child, at home, and if someone would get sick, my father, my mother, and everybody would be disturbed and concerned and worried, and they would call the doctor. And in those days, the doctors made house calls. They came to your house.
Right.
Don't do that much anymore. And we actually had a woman doctor, which was very unusual then. And as soon as she walked in the door, all the excitement and fear and so forth just stopped. People just relaxed. And that stuck with me, really.
Yeah.
As I saw that, and that was probably one of the first things that would eventually interest me in becoming a doctor.
Now, obviously, you're most famous for the Heimlich maneuver, but you've had quite a rich life of medical innovation aside from that. Could you tell me a little bit? I'm very much interested in your time as a doctor in the Navy in China, and what that was like.
It was in World War II, and I joined the Navy as a doctor, and I was called into Washington to the Chief of Naval Operations office. And I came in there, and sitting at a table were four medical officers from that office, and one of them said, "Dr. Heimlich, this is a voluntary duty. You don't have to take it. If you don't want it, we'll send you back to wherever you're going to go. All we can tell you is that it is extra hazardous duty in China."
The experience there, I know that there was one incident with a young Chinese soldier who had been shot in the lung, and he died on the operating table. And I know that that stuck with you and eventually led to a rather significant innovation on your part to save lives. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. The war had ended, and a week later, or 2 weeks later, I was still stationed there, and suddenly I hear people yelling, and they're carrying a man up, a patient, and it's a Chinese soldier, and he got shot in the chest. Actually, it had been an accident. One of his buddies, then they were on horses, and he had not locked his gun, and the gun had just shot this man who was behind him. And he was unconscious already, had bled a lot, and he had a substantial tear in his chest. The lung was collapsed. I tried to just clean it up and tried to stop the bleeding, and very shortly after, he just died right in my hands. And I was a young doctor. This was the first patient I had who died. Not through anybody's fault, but that was the case.
Did that lead you to the innovation of the chest drain valve? One of your famous.
It caused me to be to never forget it. And many years later, long after the war, actually it was about 1960s, I was lecturing to medical students in one of the hospitals I worked in. And I was a chest surgeon. That became my specialty, one of the first chest surgeons. I was telling them that after you operate on the chest, you have some blood in the chest, some bleeding maybe still going on, some fluid, you have air in the chest. So there was a patient there who I was demonstrating on, and he has this tube you see coming out of the chest that you put in after the operation, and it goes down to bottles on a floor, three bottles, and these bottles are connected to an electric system which causes suction. And so the blood and the air are sucked up by this, sucked out by this apparatus. And the patient is tied down basically for 2 to 3 weeks and can't get out, and he's tied down in bed. And I was saying the way this works is it works like a valve. It takes the air and the blood out, doesn't let any get back in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm driving after that, and I thought, why not a valve instead of that complicated apparatus? And I think of different kinds of valves. And if you have a flutter valve, which has a flap on it up and down, that would be all right. But if a clot got under it, air would get back into the chest and collapse the lung. And there was no valve that seemed appropriate. I said, but there's a flutter valve. Flutter valve is two pieces of plastic tubing which are against each other and that they stay closed. But air and fluid can get through without any air getting back in. Well, I actually ran to the 5 and 10 cent store and I bought what we call a jet for a dime, as a noisemaker for a New Year's Eve, you know?
Yeah.
And that consists of such a tubing as I described. So I bought one, and a patient came in a couple of weeks later with a collapsed lung. I got his permission, and I hooked up this sterilized noisemaker on the drainage tube. And I stayed with him day and night for 2 nights, and the lung came up and stayed up. So I took this and I went to Becton Dickinson, which is one of the largest medical equipment companies in the world. And they looked at it and they studied it for a couple of weeks and immediately took it and are manufacturing it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And it's still in use? It is still in use today?
Well, let me tell you, among other things, the Vietnam War was on, and I presented the valve at a medical society, AMA, American Medical Association meeting, and showed them how it worked. And in my mind, it was for after surgery or after a wound of the chest. And doctors who were at the meeting came up, and they were in Navy uniforms, and they were far advanced doctors, and one of them said to me, "Dr. Heimlich," and this was in New York City where I lived at that time, "I'm going to, we're from the National Medical Society in Washington, D.C. I'm going to go back from New York here and pick up a plane tomorrow, and I'm going to stop off here again, and I want you to give me 6 of your valves, then I'm going to take them to Vietnam." And, of course, I did that. And I heard nothing. And 3 weeks later, I received a telegram. "The Heimlich chest drain valve is life-saving. Must have 100. Well, eventually there were some doctors who were also doctors in the Navy or Army, and so many of them ordered valves that they ran out of them, and it got up as far as the doctor to the then President of the United States as to why they don't have enough Heimlich drainage valves. And they had been making them by hand, so that delayed them, but they got them done all automatically, you know, it took several weeks. And what was happening was that every single soldier in the Navy and Army in Vietnam was given a Heimlich chest drain valve in a sterile envelope in his pocket. And when your buddy got shot in the chest, you took this valve out, which just consisted of a tube and the valve that would let air and fluid and blood out, but nothing come back in, and put it in the bullet hole. It ended up with, when by the war ended, 26,000 Heimlich chest drain valves had been used. It then got out to the entire public, and from that time on, the company was providing 100,000 valves a year to the places that did chest surgery throughout the United States and now in Europe, and they still have more than those being used. So each one saving a patient from being tied up to the suction machine. The next day after surgery, they can get out and walk around, and they can go home with the valve in and come back 2 or 3 weeks later to the hospital.
Obviously, you were most famous for the Heimlich maneuver. Could you tell me a little bit about how and why you developed that?
I was reading the newspaper one Sunday, and here was a report of a person choking to death while eating. And it gave some of the history in the story that there are, I think the figure was somewhere around 4,000 people a year who were choking to death when they were eating because a piece of food would get into the airway, your trachea, your windpipe, mm-hmm. and close it off. And inside of less than 5 minutes, they were dead from not being able to breathe or get rid of that. And in other instances, particularly children, it could be food, but it could also be a little object like a coin that they put in their mouths and choke on. Again, there's no way to open up the airway at that time. The Red Cross, American Red Cross, was teaching that if a person is choking that way and is going to die, you hit them on the back. And they started teaching this in 1933.
Right.
And it was not saving one person. The objects would not move up at all if you hit them on the back. If anything, it would get a little deeper and tighter. And again, these people were dying since 1933. And I thought if you could compress the lung, it would be, you would squeeze it, and it would give a huge flow of air that could carry the choking object out. And I, again, know the anatomy well of the chest. And I knew if you pressed on the chest, you weren't going to do much to compress the lung, because you have the rigid chest. But you have the diaphragm, which is between the abdomen and the chest.
Right.
And if you could push that up, you'd get a huge flow of air that would carry the object away. And I did certain experiments that showed that that's what would happen. And I actually, for the first time, sought publicity to say this is a possibility to save a choking victim.
At what time was this? What year did you?
This was in 1973 and 1974.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the newspapers picked it up, and that's what I wanted, because unless you had everybody warned, you wouldn't be saving a life. So they did get out that thing. In the first 5 days, the first man was saved.
It saved so many thousands of lives. That has to give you a special kind of satisfaction in your work and your innovation.
I have now 6 or 8 procedures that are medical procedures that save people, are operations that overcome their problems, that I just feel absolutely wonderful. And I frequently get letters from people.
I wonder if you would hear from people that who have been saved by the Heimlich maneuver or one of your other innovations.
I have Google alerts.
Yeah.
From Google, and every week I get anything that's been said about me publicly, and there are every week and have been every throughout the year now for many years reports from that are in newspapers or any publication. Each one has so much difference that I just get these and I read them every week, and I'm deeply moved. And yesterday was my birthday. I received an email from a woman in Canada. Somehow it had been mentioned that it was my birthday. And she wished me a happy birthday, that she had saved her 3-year-old daughter with the Heimlich maneuver.
That's wonderful. There's been resistance to the Heimlich maneuver. Obviously, even the American Red Cross still doesn't recommend it. I mean, how does that make you feel?
Terrible.
But this Heimlich maneuver has been taught to thousands and thousands of people. You can hardly go anywhere where a person is not in the room who knows how to do this. That has to give you some satisfaction. Good satisfaction that it is being used and it's working and saving lives.
Oh, yes. It's with me always. As I say, when I get the Google Alert reports, which are all from magazines, newspapers, publications, the movies, I'm deeply moved by it.
Just in conclusion, as a young man, and as a young man becoming a doctor, could you ever have imagined the life that you have led and the innovations that you have come up with? How do you look back on all that?
I never said to myself, hey, you're going to invent some things that are going to save millions of people. I just got ideas of, as I say, 9 or 10 things are out there now. I just got ideas that I became interested in and worked to carry them out and then worked to get them used widely. And I don't sort of plan, you know, what are we going to do next? It just dawns on me when something comes up that I have done it. And I do appreciate the thanks I've been gotten.
Well, Dr. Heimlich, thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for all that you've done.
Thank you.